Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. I appreciate, again, all the responses, questions, and comments you've had in the emails. I appreciate that, and it helps guide a further discussion. I have some questions that I want to lead with, and I want to be sure that at the end of answering the questions you have at this time. So if we need to hang around a little bit past the top of the hour at the end, if you have questions, be sure and mention them. And if you have anything you want to add or ask right now, please do so. I'll keep this on discussion mode for just a bit. So I'll launch, but feel free to interrupt me. A couple of questions that I think are really excellent about addressing with a client various things like negative thought loops and stuckness, and how to think about that from a neuroscience perspective. Think about anything that is negative self-talk, self-blame, a thought you can't get out of your head, just recurring negative things, fears, worries. Think about, especially if that's recurring, think about considering three steps. And this is describing self-directed neuroplasticity. There are three steps to change your brain and change your operating system. One, as soon as you recognize that you're in that thought loop, you have a beginning thought, a fear, a worry, a rumination, negative self-talk, nip it in the bud. Immediately recognize that as an error message from your brain. Your brain is simply doing its job description to protect you, it thinks, from things that are threatening and needing to warn you. So this has become hardwired. Think about how fears, worries, ruminations, obsessions, they feel so automatic because they are. So the first step, as soon as you recognize that in the first word or two, first recognize it as an error message from your brain, and then reframe it. Reframe to an opportunity, a challenge, something. Could I get someone is on a computer phone or a cell phone. If you're not about to talk, would you mute, please, so the technical static doesn't happen? Thank you, if that did. Think about stopping that thought, an error message from your brain. You're appreciating that your brain is hardwired to warn you. So instead of that ushering in an entire scenario of a state of mind that everything is preset, all the things you worry about, it's like an auto respond and a recording. Think about it to recognize it. Reframe it immediately as, what's the opportunity here? Instead of going down that problem pathway or the repetition of the fear, the worry, the negative self-talk, what's the possibility here? And then the third is simply to refocus on what's the next step. So there are three R's here. Recognize, reframe, and refocus. Because the framework we choose determines the entire mindset that we boot up to focus and respond. So this is a way, in the first seconds, rather than getting caught up in that response that you're all too familiar with, there will always be the pull of the old and the discomfort with the new. So no matter how much you don't like it, no matter how much it's uncomfortable, there's a pull to that because it's familiar. And there's a repetition that doesn't take the energy, it seems, as trying something new and different and creating something that's going to create a bit of discomfort in the beginning. So think about this as looking at how can you more empathically appreciate what your clients are going through simply by reflecting on what it's like for you to do something that's different, unaccustomed, even one step into a different scenario, a different way of responding, is going to signal that there's some kind of discomfort because it's new and different. And that's the job description of your mind and your brain. Remember the error detection mechanism of the brain. It says, this is not what I expected. You're creating something new and different. No matter if it's what you want, this is not what we expected. Let's get back to the familiar. So your mind is saying, let's see what we can create. And your brain is saying, no, let's get it right. Let's get back to the familiar. So think about this. With every step your client makes when they are engaging in a new way of thinking, a new way of behaving, trying something different, recognize and possibly empathically appreciate that that is different and that it's not easy to do that and they're uncertain about it. And listen for how they interpret that experience. They take one step into the new, into the exciting, and it's not what they expect. So it registers as, this isn't right. Now, if they read that as, well, my gut's telling me this isn't right, or my intuition says I've made a mistake, that's a misinterpretation. And this is where you may want to collaboratively help them frame this as a signal of being in new territory, a signpost of doing something different, and staying with it a little bit longer and a little bit stronger each time, because it's all too easy, even though it's frustrating, to go back into that old pattern, the negative thought loop. So think about if that might help to recognize error message from your brain, to reframe it and refocus. Now, this is a mini exercise. This is one small step at a time. This is no zooming out and big theory. This is one step of doing something different, of just waking up, getting grounded and centered instead of beginning to worry. This is a small step. So this can be, I think, very, very important to look at and be able to help someone understand that. Now, another question, jump in, and if there are questions or comments. Another question is about dealing with a client who feels stuck and just can't think of anything, and you want to suggest all kind of things. We're going to come back to that urge. but for the stuckness, and can I ask for a management of the paper, because your microphone is picking that up. I want to leave this on discussion mode for just a little bit longer. If you'll manage the background noise, please. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, we'll come back and discuss if you have questions or thoughts, jot them down. For stuckness, one way would be to collaboratively look at that in terms of the simplest possible way with a client. What would we be able to observe in your behavior to know exactly what you want? In other words, you're wanting to look at collaboratively engaging the client at the next step. You know, they're feeling stuck, and that probably has zoomed out to the frustration instead of staying with the framework and the next step. So what could we observe in your behavior to know that that's what you want? In other words, have you put it into action? Have you taken an initial step? what behavior would demonstrate you acting to do that? Is there a component that you could begin doing right now to get some traction? And can you describe how you'd feel when you do what you want to do? The reason we do what we decide to do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it, consciously or not. And here's a coaching consideration about the two most basic components of our motivation as human beings beyond effectiveness. And this is the biological functions of avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. When your client, for example, has a plan to do something and gets to the point and decides not to do it, consciously or unconsciously, they're anticipating some greater pain with proceeding with that next step than with stopping and going back to their default mode. It may simply be the uncertainty, the trepidation of something that's new and different, but there's a pain that they're avoiding in some way, and they're seeking pleasure to have the predictable, the familiar, the relief of not doing that. So the coaching question at this juncture, and this is not to be taken, as I view it at least, pejoratively, like, well, somebody's trying to sabotage themselves, or they're trying to create... No, they're responding to something biologically that just manifests in their behavior. These are some of the algorithms we're talking about that manifest in stopping themselves short of doing what they want to do. So to make this more conscious, one way would be to address both sides of this. What is the greater pain if you don't do what you need to do or want to do? And what's the greater pleasure if you do what you need or want to do? So we're addressing that and looking at both sides so that the client can become conscious of these two biological functions of avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. How can they seek pleasure? How can they avoid pain without sabotaging themselves, understand that, and frame it in a way that they can proceed in the way that they perhaps want or need to? So that may raise some questions, but I hope it clarifies. One other brief thing, and this combines the curse of knowledge and why not just give a client advice or information or suggestions. Same answer. It creates closure rather than a continued exploration. So here's a study. Let's look at this from a totally different perspective because it's going to come back to the same place. A study of college-level tutors had the title, "Why Do Only Some Events Cause Learning During Human Tutoring?" Why do events cause learning? Well, the best learning occurred at the point that the student reached an impasse and was ready and wanted to receive input. So the biggest gains were collaboratively engaging that challenge or struggle at the time that it occurred, not functioning for the students. Tutors actually impaired learning when they provided answers and support too quickly, and particularly when the student was not at an impasse. So this gets to why do we not give answers, suggestions, advice? Because I think that fosters codependency. What's the message when we give advice or information or instruction to a client? It says, "I don't quite believe you'll be able to figure this out. I got a better answer." Now, that's from my system and superimposed on your system. Maybe you can make it fit. But This is why we want to catalyze growth internally from the client's own story, from their sense of self, which gets us to what we should be talking about in our initial topic in the final seminar about upgrade your operating system, writing new stories, is about the brain's sense of self. This is something that I think we need to can be very useful for us to be aware of in coaching, and that's how the client really has a sense of self and an identity that is part of their operating system. So practically what that means, if they do something different and they don't incorporate that change into how and who they see themselves, their operating system, it won't hang around. They won't repeat it. If they incorporate that as part of a revised, a transformed operating system, then it's going to be the experience that will gradually become more and more automatic. So what this means, in just in a practical way, whatever you think, feel, and experience are what you create each moment. To say that slightly differently, whatever you experience, you either create or you agree to. So what we do as mentor coaches is to help someone inhabit their story, to own their storyline, to own what they think and feel and experience, and to look together at what works and what doesn't work, and to engage together what doesn't work. So this change that will register immediately as discomfort is going to be important to frame how that's processed for the client. If they see it as, this is expectable because I haven't done it before, or if they rely on a limiting assumption or a false assumption, here's how that sounds. Well, I need to be confident before I really try something different. I need to be comfortable before I launch this aspect of my practice. Our minds and brains don't work that way. Comfortable and confident are not a place we began and certainly are not a prerequisite. So they're a limiting or a false assumption that need to be addressed by us as coaches in an empathic way so that someone can appreciate and tolerate taking step by step and reframing the discomfort of the experience of doing something new and different, not as this means it's wrong or is it, this is my gut telling me that it's not the right move, but to look at it and assess and plan to look in a systematic way. Remember, we started here to look at a way to think about change is to look at that as a system. If you want to change, not focus just on the goal, but focus on the system, the map. That's what we do in coaching. We ask the client at the beginning of the session, what would you like us to focus on? And then where would you like us to get to? And then we progress together to get to that destination that the client has determined. So this means that throughout that coaching session, the client is not experiencing the comfort of the repetition of the old mode. They're experiencing co-creating something different, so they have a partner and an accountability partner in that with you. They're experiencing the anticipation of the challenge. And that's the dopamine hit gradually that will foster wanting to do, engage, and try something new and different. And to not have it foreclosed either by suggestion or comment or an answer, or to go back to their old story. The quickest way to end that discomfort is instantly to go back to an old story. And that can be an emotional trigger. It instantly boots up that old mindset. So this is something I think is really important to understand with our client in the process as we're seeing together. This is our language and our concept. Remember I said the client does not think of what they're doing and experiencing as their story. This is a metaphor we're using, or I'm using, to listen to the story and to see where we may collaboratively co-create new aspects of that. But the client is experiencing, this is the way it is. So we're listening for the process of understanding how their minds and brains work. And remember I said every algorithm that determines thinking, feeling, behaving will manifest in the coaching collaboration with you. And you'll see it, you'll see evidence of it, and you'll have an opportunity for you and the client together to engage that, because it will repeat. If you miss it the first time, it'll come around again. If the client is not quite ready, then they'll let you know, and it'll come around again. So this, I think, is important as we listen to our clients and hear what they're saying as well as what they're not saying, to decisions made, to decisions chosen, and to decisions unchosen, which I think is an important part of decision-making in and of itself. So these are aspects that we may want to come back to if there are questions about that. So this is where you'll jump in, I think, and find your place in the outline, for those of you who are following the outline, which I'm not, obviously. Think about pre-commitment to something. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He's been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyhow. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all subsequent pleas for release until they're safely past danger. So this management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against what is predictable and potentially fatal. So fast forward then to our work with clients. We're collaboratively co-creating a story each coaching session where they determine the focus and they determine the outcome. And that pre-commitment, that collaborative focus on the game plan, is a model that they download while we're talking about the whole experience and process, content and process. So that model, when they sit at their desk the next morning, and their usual way of doing things is to look at three or four or five things that they got to do, if they follow that model, once it's in place, it's not going to be the next morning, they may decide on what their focus is of picking one thing, and what their destination, what they want to do with that, where they want to get to 15 minutes later. This is especially helpful. I hadn't planned, but let me tell you a story because I think it might illustrate here. This is especially useful, I believe, with clients who have some form of attention challenges. I worked with a guy who had a regional firm. I'm going to keep this homogenized for identity. He had a regional firm, and he wanted to go national, but he was being challenged because he had difficulty with attention. He could work beautifully. And this is one of the things we figured out. When did he work the best? When was he absolutely most productive? And it was when he had total and unobstructed focus on what he did on his computer. And during, it was 3 or 4 hours that he did that. But what interfered with that was he would have curbside consults from other people in the firm who would seek his advice. He would have calls. He would have emails. He had various people dropping by or wanting to schedule things. So he had to use a lot of energy to disrupt that attention, focus on whatever it was, and then back to what he decided to do. So he knew he was compromised, and he knew he had kind of stalled at doing what he wanted to do and his plan. So what we looked at carefully was the step-by-step process of what he did and how he worked just moment by moment as he did that. So what he learned to do, fast forward to the end, what he learned to do was to determine when his most creative time of the day was and to focus entirely on what he most needed and wanted to do during that time, and to have his personal assistant protect that time. No curbside consults, no emails, no pings, no calls. He only focused in an immersed way during that, it was a 3.5 hour period, and he became more productive in that 3.5 hour period than he did in his usual day. Now, in addition, we looked at when he had different kinds of things to do to cluster what required the same state of mind. When he did the curbside consults with people who came, they were scheduled now, back to back, 45 minutes. The calls, when people called in, they were told when they would get a call back. And his assistant orchestrated that, and he did all of that in about a 50 to 60 minute period of time. So he became extremely more productive. Also, when he sat down at his computer, he operated on a Big Mac, so you have, you know, a lot of margin on the left and right, you know. So what we looked at doing was to structure that, to create a map moment by moment and for the day, so that to the left of his screen, he had a post-it note, a larger post-it note, with hour by hour what he was going to do. So it was structured. He knew where he was at any moment. And to the right, he had a small post-it note with what he would do that hour, and he put 2 or 3 or whatever bullets, so that he had a map for his day and for his hour, so he was always focused, so he lost no energy with his own focus and with interference with that focus. And especially since he was challenged. And when he did that, he didn't have ADD. He had a firm that went national and ultimately public. So he was able to transcend that by carefully planning and going through a stepwise process of what he needed to do. So these are things I wanted to share with you to think about how you can help someone create a model that they will internalize and that they will use the other 7 days and 23 hours when you aren't on the horizon, that can be part of the incorporation of a systematic way to do things. So if there are questions about this, I want to come back to them at the end, but I want to review some, a little bit broader focus here. Review some aspects of engineering effective change. This is what we do, whatever we call it, this is what we do with our clients, is to help them facilitate, for us to be a catalyst for them to change. And we've been talking about how they incorporate that change and make it part of their identity and their operating system. But here's some things to think about as we co-construct a game plan with our client. One, and this is in your outline, focus specifically on the next step. Whatever the goal is, let's go back to the coaching session. Client has a focus, a destination. First step, what do they focus on? And if they zoom out, focus on the next step. What's the first thing that would give you some track? Well, I need to make a decision about my career. What's the first step that would give you some traction in that decision? Now, I'd probably want to know other things about what their best way of making decisions would be, but we'll come back to that. But here's an example of focusing specifically on the next step. This is a true story. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Terry had an artificial leg, so his running style was a shuffle and a hop, but he managed to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was immediately interviewed after he completed the marathon and was asked how he managed to do it. He must have been exhausted and knew he still had thousands of miles ahead. How did you do it? He said, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. Now, he knew that those telephone poles ended at the end of the Marathon of Hope, but he just did one telephone pole at a time. Two, specify the next step. Not abstract, not too broad. Some is not a number, soon's not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. When you get to the closure in the coaching session with your client and ask based on what the next to last question may be, what's the most important thing you're taking away from our discussion today? So they've got it locked in so it's more memorable and repeatable. Then based on that, what do you commit to do before we meet again? And a commitment begins with I will. So I'm going to push until I hear an I will, and it contains some semblance of a SMART goal, and the T on the end is time-bound because it's going to be something that can be done before our session next time. So that's a plan. Three, make change tangible and concrete. A yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going. The coaching discussion, the coaching story is this every time, that you can measure progress along the way within that discussion. And you can tell what's detour and distraction. That's, as we've discussed before, that's the essence of a map. A map has two coordinates, where you are, where you're going. And with a map, you can tell what's detour and what's distraction. You can measure progress along the way. This is validating. This is internally validating, so the client ultimately will not need you to do that. They have 15 minutes dedicated to something when they sit down at their desk. They can tell where they are at any time. My guy could look at the screen initially. Ultimately, he didn't need those sticky notes, although he kept doing them throughout our time together. You can see and measure progress. That's reward. Make progress for. Make progress measurable. Demystify the journey, a specific destination with tangible focuses on the next step. 5, make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones, and I would say a celebration of each small victory, because the process that you're going through with your client is one that's being internalized. You're collaboratively co-creating an experience with them that they can measure and feel the accomplishment step by step. You're doing it with them and you're highlighting that. That may not be what they're accustomed to do, to take one step at a time and feel good about it or measure the progress, and especially to celebrate in their own way and with you each step. So one example, kind of a goofy example, but it's, I think, a very valid example of shrinking a task to a tangible next step is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time, because that's really all you can do. And I've heard people who have been very successful at that, you know, sometimes it needs to be 5 minutes at a time. This shrinks the change to something that's manageable, specific, tangible. A small target leads to small victories, and it's the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. The most basic motivation we have intrinsically as human beings is to be effective. I've seen direct infant observation studies of kids as early as 4 months of age who have effectance pleasure, the pleasure at being a cause. When we create something and feel effective, that's an intrinsic reward. So that requires a plan, but all you ever have to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to an immediate step of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. Now, we've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change, and to see if it works. The scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry. Does create discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. We need to be resonant with both aspects of that with our client, the discomfort and the growth. You know, I understand that this is not an easy step, and I hear how exciting it is for you when you did what you did that worked, or was something way better than that. Okay, so these are some things that can be considerations when we think about what's the role of emotion with choices. We're talking about choices, but we're also appreciating this is an entire human being. One is increased tension produces emotional regression. So I think we need to appreciate for a client with increased tension, the stress can move them into a more emotional pattern. And that may be a signal that the first order of business is regulating their state of mind to get grounded and centered to engage with us, because this is the model of what they'll need to do when they sit down at that desk first thing in the morning, to get grounded and centered to consider one thing at a time from a balanced state of mind. So also, I think we can appreciate how increased emotion narrows perspective, and emotion can even shift things away from the logical, contemplative parts of our brain. In a totally emotional situation, the emotional brain can seize and hold hostage the reasoning brain. So this is something we're listening for, is how regulated, how balanced, how grounded and centered someone is, And if they're not, to focus on that process first. That's important, to then consider whatever else they do, because this develops self-reflection. I mentioned early on a couple of studies, Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review, studied executives who were the most successful to find what was the outstanding thing above all others. Was it degrees, experience? The most important variable was their ability to self-reflect and regulate emotion. Remember when I mentioned that early on? This is key. This is what we do as mentor coaches, is to help someone appreciate how vital that is, because when you're in a grounded and centered state, you have access to all of the information in all of your states of mind. So, and like my guy at the Big Mac, lump tasks according to states of mind required to do them, because it takes energy to shift a state of mind. Every time he got a call, a ping, a curbside consult, whenever you have to change your state of mind, it takes three times as much energy. You're focused on something, you have to stop, refocus, and then get back to what you were doing. Kind of analogous to what we're talking about. It takes as much energy to on television as it does to run it for the next 4.5 to 5 hours. This is the role of the regulation of state of mind and the value of doing that. So this, I think, is important. Now, I want to mention a little bit, an example, but choice architecture is about how we frame something, and that boots up a particular mindset and state of mind to deal with that. The simplest example is, what we know now is the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the recipient, the listener. If those first few words are perceived as collaborative, engaging, it boots up a mindset that's mediated primarily by oxytocin, the neurochemical system of connection and bonding. Everything subsequent in that immediate conversation will be processed through that system. If those first few words are perceived as threatening or pejorative, it boots up a different mindset that is about trust and protection. And that's a different neurochemical. It will process the remainder of that immediate conversation. So here's, and you may have heard of this study, but it's just a classic example. It involves a car wash. Okay. A study at a local car wash ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Every time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card, and when they filled up their card with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card where they needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But they were given a head start in that they received their cards, 2 stamps had already been added. So it was basically the same. Both needed 8 stamps. But the psychology and the motivation was really different. For those who had a head start, they were already 20% of the way there. Now, several months later and several iterations of this, results were in. 19% of the 8 stamp customers got a free car wash. 34% of the head start group earned a free car wash. And this group earned their car wash, free car wash faster, meaning they were ready to start over, so it was almost twice the difference, more than twice the difference. So I think that's important, because people are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or a journey than just to be looking at the next step or beginning on a shorter one. So what this means is that we as mentor coaches can keep the big picture in mind and hear what the client is saying and doing and how things manifest in this moment, but also look at where they want to go so that we can keep that in mind and validate progress. Now, I hear how good it sounds that you made this step. Or look at where you are now with this compared to where you were 2 months ago. Help them develop this observing aspect of themselves so that when they're just with themselves, they can validate progress. This is a vital self-function that is along with planning, because this is part of the reward that's internal, that's validating, that they can measure progress themselves. So this is important, I think, as we think about how do you frame something. How you frame something can change the meaning. How you perceive the first few words can change the framework. And I mentioned way earlier, our brains can't recognize the difference between excitement and anxiety. How we frame it determines which direction we go. If it's anxiety, better head for cover. If it's excitement, then we plan about how to move ahead and keep that going. So here's one example of this. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that they don't want to. In other words, the framework is they have to opt out. They have to initiate leaving. The rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries have a form where if someone does donate their organs, unless they check that they have to check the box to donate their organs, they have to actively opt in, rate of donation, 18%. So think about how this is used in marketing and neuromarketing, neuroeconomics, using this to the force-free trial. You get 3 months of subscription, but then you got to opt out. And I think last I saw, 82% of people don't opt out, but only 20% of the 62% don't read the subscriptions after that. So this is how it's important to listen to the process and the context of what we're looking at with our clients, of how we help them focus and plan and create a game plan for what they do each session with us, as well as where they want to get to. Now, I don't know how you guys do it. You probably, if you trained at CTA, you probably have a welcome packet. I call mine the client information packet. It's something that I ask a client to fill out prior to their first session that has, it's about 3 pages maximum, that asks them to reflect on where they want to get to, what they want to do, what they expect from me and them. But it gives us both an idea of what they want to accomplish in coaching. So I think this is something that's useful to have an overview, and it also helps the client to focus on what their purpose in coaching is. It can inform what we do in a day-by-day and moment-by-moment experience. So I want to be sure that I'm covering all of the... Let me just close by a couple of things, so I want to leave a little bit of time for discussion. Here's a final illustration about roadblocks to success. I know we don't focus on negative, but hang with me for the story. Darren Brown did an experiment in the UK in London on Regent Street, which is a lot of pedestrian traffic. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out on the sidewalk. He then drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, sort of like the crime scenes on TV. And then he walked away, leaving the wallet with the money sticking out, just lying there. Hundreds of people walked past this wallet. Most saw it. Many stopped to look at it, but not a single person would pick it up. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. This yellow chalk circle limited people from simply picking up the wallet. So the question to you, what is your yellow chalk circle? It's any assumption that limits you, and assumptions can be conscious and unconscious. Part of what we do as coaches, once something that's unconscious is recognized, it's no longer unconscious. This is how we help collaboratively to look at and engage with someone in their operating system. So here's a summary of listening as mentor coaches. We become accustomed to listening to a story without trying to fix it, but to collaboratively move it along for the client's goals and attainment. So first, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, as a coach, don't take it personally. I'll give you an example of that if we have time. Listen to the language, whether it's active or passive. How someone constructs a sentence can tell you how they view their own authority. Well, it just happened to me, or this obstacle stopped me. Listen to the point of reference, whether it's internal or external. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or others. Listen to the initiation of action, whether it's proactive or reactive. That's the point of reference. If someone is reacting, they have immediately given the point of reference to the other person and are reacting to it. It seems easier, but it's significantly limiting. And listen for how centered the speaker is in his or her experience. You probably had the experience of listening to, let's say, somebody being interviewed right after, an athlete being interviewed right after a game. And it's always first person, politician, athlete, whatever. It's always first person, I. But then if they suddenly slip to say you, there's something that they may be distancing or wanting to disavow and move to the position of an observer instead of an experiencer. I've only done this two or three times with clients, but to point out, and I get permission from every client to interrupt them so we can immediately look at something if I think it's going to be helpful at that moment, give them permission to interrupt me. To interrupt them, I say, did you notice that you moved from saying I in your experience to suddenly saying you? And I waited, and the person would reflect and say, yeah, I realize now how uncomfortable I was with that, or that was something I was really embarrassed about, and I wanted to kind of step away from it. So this kind of observation, collaboratively, I think can be very useful. So another thing we listen for is the state of mind of the speaker, the client, and whether that state of mind is regulated and fits the task. If they began the session being grounded and centered, or if we need to do something to help them get grounded and centered. And this, as I mentioned, the self-reference in the first or second person, are they still at the center of their experience? So some elements of coaching successful change, co-creating things. Let's review the important elements we've talked about. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems to create a mindset and new brain pathways. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits with an eye on the prize to lay new mental maps. Regulate a state of mind and manage emotions, beginning with coach before you have the engagement with the client. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain, right brain, intellectual and emotional. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. Focus on successes, on challenges, on opportunities, rather than obstacles, problems, or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. That's what we're doing consistently. In the event of diversion by the client to an old feeling or behavior or a problem, I would say immediately redirect to the client's focus and the idea and the flow that they're developing, and use that as information about what it's like to be that person. Remember, the client is always showing you what it's like to be them. So we use this to help them be more aware of how their mind's working and what works and what doesn't work. Remember that the power is in the focus, and that permanent change comes from consistency of that focus and stepwise progression to goals, one at a time. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight can change the mind and brain. Also think about conceptualizing a meta map, looking with the client in order to master and internalize the process, to step back and look at where they've been, where they are now, where they want to go periodically so that they can incorporate this process and a way of self-reflection. So here are a couple of things that I want to be sure that you think about. You've embraced your growth mindset to engage in our discussions. Now, the magician, Harry Houdini, reminded us, just because something is not explained doesn't mean it's supernatural. And, to paraphrase a no longer with us author, Garrison Keillor, be well, be happy, go out and do good things. Now, it's been my pleasure and privilege to discuss these notions with you in these four seminars. And I hope we have additional opportunity to collaborate. I want to take us off of, one other thing, and this is kind of a response to a couple of questions condensed, okay? Possibility-focused coaching can be practically stated in these ways. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. If it's not broken, don't fix it. Small steps can lead to big changes. And the solution is not necessarily related to the problem. So we're in discussion mode now. If you have thoughts or questions or want to add, I want to add one thing, and this is strictly from Texas. it's always easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. So stick with your client, collaboratively co-create something that you both plan. Questions, thoughts, or clarifications? What you got?
Natalie here?
Yes, go for it. Who is this?
Natalie.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to say about this session, the very first part, for me, I thought it was a very beautiful, eloquent representation of basically the law of manifestation expressed in the neuroscience way. Everything you mentioned about, you know, the recognize, reframe, refocus, think, feel, experience, like everything is, you know, the hamster thought and becoming aware, like, you know, thought become things. It was very beautifully expressed. And I just want to mention that my takeaway from this session is the client is always showing you what it's like to be them. And that's so true. And everything is actually so insightful. Thank you so much again, Dr. Kruger.
Thank you. I'll keep talking to you if you call me Dave. Thank you very much, Natalie. And your check of appreciation is in the mail for your comment. So what else? Anybody else? Any questions or clarifications or things you'd like to add or ask?
This is Gail.
Yeah.
It's not a question or anything you said. That's been great, other than the fact that I can't write fast enough. So how long are the recordings going to be available?
There's not a time limit on them for that reason. They'll be available to you, access by that link, at least a year, but I think ongoing.
Very good. Thank you.
And I'll be sure they're each posted. And if there are any technical questions about access to them, contact Bernadette with support@coasttrainingalliance.com. She handles the recordings and access to them. But you shouldn't have any problem.
All right.
And
remember, I see that, because there's so much stuff that it needs to be processed slower than within an hour.
I know. And I always have the kind of the conundrum. I would very much like to do a seminar type presentation with discussions and that sort of thing. But there's so much information I want to convey that those two are pretty much in contradistinction to each other. So I hope you've tolerated my sea of words and can go back and sort of digest them in a bit. And if there are any questions or if I can be of help in any way, you have my email and feel free to contact me. I'll be eager to hear what you do with this and if it's useful to you in an ongoing way. I value any kind of feedback and will be eager to help whenever possible.
Thank you.
Who else? What else? Well, again, thank you very much. It's been a privilege to do this with you. I really appreciate your feedback and emails and comments. And don't hesitate to let me know if I can be of additional help to you. So thanks very, very much. I really appreciate. Was there a comment?
Is it okay? Is it okay to watch TV?
I think that was background noise. Thank you all very, very much. I really appreciate it. It's been a privilege. Bye now. See you guys.